Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
Things haven't been easy for an old distant friend of ours. I'm speaking of Pluto, of course. What is it about that little guy way out there discovered in March of 1930 that has captured our imagination so? Is it that he represents the lonely outer reaches of our solar system, a kind of pilgrim planet roaming the outskirts of the known universe? And why did Disney name a dog after him? I'd hoped to find a clever Mickey Mouse quote regarding Pluto by Googling Mickey and Pluto, but to no avail. Pluto, of course, was also the Roman god of the underworld before he was a planet. And now it seems that Pluto isn't even really a planet anymore, but our solar system's second largest dwarf planet, a member of the Kuiper Belt, with a highly eccentric and inclined orbit. Them are some strong words that have left a few Pluto fans out there a little miffed. To explain the current plight of Pluto for us tonight, we have with us Mr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, author of The Pluto Files, The Rise and Fall of America's Favorite Planet, which is on sale in our lobby and which he'll be signing after the program. He is rather well qualified to lead us in such a discussion, as he is not only an award-winning author and a monthly columnist for natural history, but an astrophysicist with the American Museum of Natural History and the director of the world-famous Hayden Planetarium. In conversation this evening with Mr. deGrasse Tyson is Dr. Laura Danley, curator of our very own and acclaimed Griffith Observatory, where she develops all educational, theatrical, gallery, and telescope-related programs. She holds a PhD in astronomy and is a spectroscopist. From what I understand, is one who performs spectroscopy with a spectrometer, which I gather means that she analyzes the chemistry of objects in space remotely with a kind of telescope. She specializes particularly in ultraviolet observations from satellites. This evening's program will conclude with a question and answer period for about 10, 15 minutes. Please wait to be called on and wait for the microphone to arrive. Ladies and gentlemen, won't you please join me in silencing your cell phones and in welcoming Neil deGrasse Tyson and Laura Danley to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Thank you for that introduction, and we're so happy to be here, and thank you to all of you coming this evening. It is a real thrill to be here with Neil Tyson. We've known each other for many years that I won't number, but since we were both grad students, so that's a while, and so it's a real pleasure to be here and try to moderate this controversy that has brewed around him. So I think I'll speak for everyone when I ask the first question, which is, what did Pluto do to you? Did you have a bad experience as a child with Pluto?
Pluto had it coming, that's all I want to say. Pluto, what did Pluto do to me? No, I like Pluto. I have nothing against Pluto.
Well, then why have you championed that Pluto should be removed from the roster of planets?
Well, actually, I haven't. I think that's a big misconception of where I stand on this issue. And it all began back in the late 1990s when we were trying to think about how to present the solar system as well as the rest of the universe in a newly rebuilt Hayden Planetarium in New York City. That's where I hail from. And so we noticed that a couple of things were being discovered in the outer solar system that had not been discovered before. Other icy bodies in the outer solar system. Oh, by the way, I have to say, if you ever use the phrase icy bodies to, like, kindergartners, they'll look kind of... Because they imagine, like, dead bodies frozen in the outer... So you just have to be careful how you use the word body.
So icy bodies has replaced heavenly bodies.
Heavenly
bodies. As the joke du jour. Yeah.
So we saw that these icy objects were being discovered in the outer solar system with kind of similar properties to Pluto. All odd properties. Pluto is an odd planet, but it's a normal version of what these other icy bodies are. And we realized maybe Pluto is not the ninth planet. Maybe it was the first object discovered of this new class of objects that are out there. Predicted to be there by an astronomer at mid-century called Gerard Kuiper. He's a solar system theorist who hypothesized that beyond the orbit of Neptune, that where there's no large planet, then there's no sort of nothing to sort of gravitationally vacuum up all of the debris that would have been left over from the formation of the solar system. So it would just still be out there. And there was the prediction for 50 years until someone actually, not someone, but two astronomers using the Keck telescope in Hawaii, you got to need a big telescope to see dim things, and found the next object in this zone. Then it was hailed as the first Kuiper Belt object, but it's really the second if Pluto was the first. So all we did, getting back to your question, all we did was take Pluto and group it with the rest of these other icy bodies. And then we said, well, if we're going to group objects by like properties, let's kind of do that with the rest of the solar system. So we looked at the gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, put them together, presented them. We looked at the rocky small object, Mercury, what's next? Venus, thank you. Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars.
A testament to counting planets.
I know, right, that's what I'm saying. Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, so we grouped those together because they're all small, dense, and rocky, and that was the new family photo of the solar system. At no time did we count planets. At no time did we say, there are only eight. At no time did we say, we're kicking Pluto out. Even though the press kept trying to get a quote, one of these sound bites out of him, they said, so how many planets are there? So how many planets? And I would not give it to him. And what I said was, is that all we said, what I wanted to say, because they were like pissing me off after a while, I wanted to say, yeah, we kicked Pluto out. It was too small to make it in New York, you know. I wanted to like give him something to chew on. And so, but what happened was after we did this, then a year later, the New York Times broke the story. I mean, that exhibit was that way for a year. And we thought, oh, everybody's cool. Nobody, it wasn't going to ruffle any feathers. They broke the story. And out came a page one headline in the New York Times. They said, Pluto not a planet? Only in New York. And that's what started. That's where the planet count adjustment got saddled on my shoulders.
And that's where you became the hitman.
The hitman.
Target.
And I got the newspaper right here. Can I?
Oh, wonderful.
Okay. Right there. Okay. Now, this is a newspaper that should have been filled with events of the day, not Pluto. This is...
Yeah, do you want to tell us the date?
Yeah, the date is January 22nd, 2001. So what happened 2 days before? Like, President Bush just got elected president. And they're still counting Chads in Florida. So you think there'd be news related to that completely on this. So we got Bush, we got some Cardinals got appointed, some brownouts in California, some... weapons factories in Iraq, and right there, there you go. Pluto not a planet, only in New York. There it is. And that's when the phone just started ringing, and my inbox flooded, and the hate mail started coming in from third graders. That's how that happened.
So tell us a little bit about that hate mail. You describe it in the book, and it's very entertaining, but what were some of your favorite threats?
They were pissed. I mean, I've never seen angry. What does a third grader have to be angry about? They were angry about this. And one letter said, oh, dear Dr. Tyson, please put my favorite planet back in, and here's what it looks like. And drew, squirt. And some letters are transcribed, but the cutest ones are actually, for the Pluto files, are scanned in so you can see the crayon and the bad spelling and one of them says, and But here's what it looks like so that you can make your exhibit on it, right, right? And it says, right, one of them says, write back soon, but not in cursive. I don't know how to read cursive yet. It was the cutest.
And I love the ones that are signed love, you know, love Susie, love Bobby. That's all they know how to sign now.
Right, right. There's right. no other sincerely yours. You know, that's right. not, they
You've
don't teach that.
You've ruined the solar system. Love Susie.
That's right. So the that was not the only correspondence that came in. Some came in from colleagues, angered colleagues. Most of those who were angered are those for whom their entire professional identity flowed out of Pluto being the ninth planet. Others were pretty cool about it, actually. But I got an email from school teachers and from science teachers, and it became clear after a while that science teachers were making this debate a unit in the class. So I got, like, it wasn't just single letters from students, but whole packets full, right? And they all just sort of give their case. So it really, it was a complete distraction of my life for years. Years.
And is it still? Is there a still?
No, it's not so bad. No, thanks for asking. It's not so bad now because so all these years go by and it still goes on and it goes on and it goes on. And then finally, like, the international community of astrophysicists decided to bring it to vote. The International Astronomical Union, not a labor union, but a society. And in their triennial, which I think means every 3 years, that's what I intended to mean, triennial assembly, they took a vote, but not until they had assembled a committee to decide the definition of a planet so that they can then decide whether Pluto was a planet or not. Now, this sounds like, what are you guys, idiots or something you're asking me? I'm sure. It's not that the astronomers were all idiots. It's that no one had ever officially defined the word planet since the time of ancient Greece. That's why there was the debate. See, if it hadn't been defined, it's okay if there's no objects to test the definition that didn't exist. But all of a sudden, we're starting to get objects that sort of force you to think deeper about what you had been assuming all along. And the original definition of planet is the Greek planetes, meaning wanderer. And in ancient Greece, there were just seven objects in the sky that wandered against the background sky. And there were only seven. And it was Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the Sun, and the Moon. And we traced the names of our 7 days of the week to those seven objects through both Roman and, here in the West, Roman and Norse mythology. So Saturdays after Saturn, Sundays after the Sun, Mondays after the Moon, you know, that sort of thing. So those were the seven planets, unambiguously defined. No argument. Do you move? You're a planet. Period. But then Copernicus came along. Well, maybe the Sun is in the middle rather than Earth, and we're moving around the Sun like the rest of these objects. So then we must be whatever we call those other objects. So we, Earth, must then be a planet. So Earth got added to the count of planets. The Sun got subtracted, and so too did the Moon. So it was seven planets initially, perfectly defined, then became minus two plus one, six. And then it was just kind of stuff that went around the Sun.
So this isn't the first time, that planets have been demoted. We've demoted planets before. There's a precedence for this.
And I think the most telling case here is in 1801, where, did you know that in 1801, the planet Ceres was discovered? Did you know this? Planet Ceres. You ever hear of planet Ceres?
If you're an astrologer, you have.
Astrologers know about this?
Oh, yeah, they've got Ceres in charts. I was going to ask you about that. Why aren't the astrologers engaged?
Oh, they are. So astrologers were as pissed off as the third graders that Pluto got demoted. So I talk about that in the book. Was this microphone lowered in intensity? Could I have it back up? Could I have it up a little? I really? So I just bring it closer then. I'll bring it closer then. How about that? Closer.
Were you ever a radio?
No, I wasn't.
You have got the voice for it.
No, that's the planetarium director voice.
Wow.
You know.
Sit
if
back.
Your voice is coming out of the dome, it can't sound like this. You know, so that doesn't work. You gotta get deep in it, you know, and then then it works.
It's cosmic talk.
Cosmic talk. So where was I before I interrupted myself?
Ceres.
So 1801, planet Ceres was discovered. Everybody was excited. And then a couple of years, you know, within a few years, three more planets were discovered in orbit around the sun between Mars and Jupiter. Because there was a big gap there that was not understood for a long while. And so if you have books in the early 1800s, the planet, and they discovered a bunch of these, the planet count was up to 13 for a while. Did you know that? 200 years ago, 13 planets. And then people said, no, wait a minute. These objects are kind of small. In fact, they're really, really small. And they're like, there's tons of them. And they're all kind of have in the same orbital zone. They have properties that are not like these other objects we've been calling planets. And so it took 50 years. But in the early 1850s, it was widely decided that maybe we were not discovering planets. We were discovering new objects, a new kind of object, in a new swath of real estate in the solar system, which then became known as the asteroid belt.
Now you say widely decided. How did it differ then to now?
Oh, because the people who discovered them wanted them to be planets. Yeah. I mean, the discoverer was not happy about the movement to say these are just little craggy chunks of rock. Let's find something else to call them.
But what's different now that we have an international body that holds a vote? I mean, is there a precedence for that, or is that something that just is really more of a symptom of 21st century
political life? No, that's a good question.
Life?
I think in the International Astronomical Union, they vote on stuff all the time. And, you know, as you know, here in America, if we discover something because we have a bigger telescope than the rest of the world, which remains the case. We have the largest optical telescopes in the world. We'll see things, discover new objects. We'll find some name, some lexicon to apply to it. It's usually a fun, playful lexicon or a very transparent lexicography. That's how we do that's what we do in astrophysics. One of the things I think we do well. So, for example, you know, spots on the sun are sunspots. See, that's how we do that. The red spot on Jupiter is called Jupiter's red spot. See? The biologist and the chemist and the geologist, they're just out of control with their words. Way too many syllables. Yeah. They lay them down, and that becomes a barrier. You can't even get to the subject because the words are in the way. So the universe is complex enough. I'm not going to put big words down and then you got to get through that before you get to me. You know, this is not my defense mechanism here. It's just so in biology, the most important molecule, deoxyribonucleic acid, right? In the universe, the most important event, Big Bang. See? We are monosyllabic people, right? We are simple people in astrophysics. So, because the universe is complex enough. So actually, if we discover something and we name it, and then Europe discovers maybe the same thing, but we don't know yet, and they name it, and finds out it's the same thing, what they do in these committees is sort of regularize the vocabulary. And that's a service to the community, so we all speak the same language. And it's hardly ever controversial. You don't hear about controversial votes that they take, yet they're taking votes all the time. So it just turned out that they felt compelled to define what a planet was 6 years after we had to actually go through that same exercise. But we did it first. We were the first public institution to represent Pluto in a way unfamiliar to the public, a way that did not match however you learned it in third grade. So we were the first to do that publicly because we were cutting metal. $200 million being invested in a new astronomy museum. And when you don't want the exhibit to go out of date 3 months later. We checked the trend line in where the research was going. And we followed that trend line, and it turned out to have the foresight that mattered that everyone else sort of came into later. So they voted. It turned out to be controversial because there was the underbelly of that vote. The 10% of the people who voted to retain Pluto's status as a planet, they're a very vocal, animated lot. And they started circulating international petitions, and they were, you know, complaining on web blogs, and it was, and they're still out there. They're still at it.
And will there be another vote in the next?
There's not a scheduled vote, but I think they're amassing the troops.
Uh-huh.
Because that vote was taken in 2006, and this is 2009, and triennial, right? Yeah. They're meeting again this year, I think, in South
Buenos
America.
Yeah, oh, no.
Sao Paulo?
Brazil.
Brazil?
Yeah. Rio de Janeiro.
Oh, cool. I should go. Yeah,
no,
let's go.
I've never been there.
No, I've never been there.
I know I miss Prague, too.
Right,
so.
Right. So getting back to the question that started this, in 2006, the official vote was taken, and that actually reclassified Pluto, not as a planet, but as a dwarf planet.
Now, why is a dwarf planet not a planet?
Well, I don't have a problem. I don't actually care what the definition of a planet is, as long as it has a definition everybody can, like, unambiguously assign. So the way it works now is, to be a planet, you need to check in two boxes. The first box is, are you round? Okay? Actually, it's three checks. First, are you round? Well, Pluto's round. So there it goes, all right? Second check. Are you the primary object that's in orbit around the sun? So you can't be a moon, even if you're round, and be called a planet. Got that? Gotcha. Okay. So the moon is not the primary object in our system going around the sun, so the moon, though round, would not be a planet in this. So Pluto, get a check there. Pluto has a moon, a relatively big moon, but it still is the biggest in the system. So Pluto gets two checks.
And the third?
The third check. The third check is, have you cleared your orbit of orbital debris? And Pluto has not. It is in a crowded zone with countless other icy bodies in the outer solar system, the Kuiper belt of comets. In just the same way, there is one round asteroid, Ceres. By the way, named for the Roman goddess of harvest, and that's a root word for the word cereal. Okay? You all are library people, so you know this stuff. Well, if you don't, I think you'd maybe even appreciate it, right? This is like the kind of stuff library people like, right? Okay.
Well, it matters very much. You can say, well, it's just a word, but
no, again, it's not. It's got
have meaning.
It's got
so
context
words.
And history,
right?
And future. So Ceres is round. It is its own dominant object. It doesn't have a moon that we know of around the sun, but it hasn't cleared its orbit. It's littered in the asteroid belt. So Pluto fails that third check. It remains a dwarf planet. Now, Laura, you make an important point. Why should a dwarf planet not be a planet? If you drive a compact car, you're not thinking, I'm not driving a car, you know? It's just
maybe you are.
Kind of a car, unless it's
the SUVs go barreling.
Oh, that's true, no. Yes. You're just more dead in an accident. That's different. Doesn't mean you're not driving a car. You're just driving a more deadly car, deadly to yourself,
car.
A dwarf car. So you get to park in the, you know, compact car spaces of the, you know, you're still in a car. So I didn't have a problem with that. I come to this as an expert in galaxies. We have dwarf galaxies, and they don't have a stick. They don't have an identity complex. No one thinks, oh, you're less of a galaxy. In fact, dwarf galaxies outnumber, quote, regular galaxies in the universe by as much as 10-1. So they get respect.
So we've heard it here tonight. Pluto is a planet.
Well, it's a kind of planet.
It's a kind of dwarf planet.
By the definition put up by the... I think there was a little concern about Pluto's feelings. So there's another subcategory of round object that Pluto is sort of the benchmark version of, and Pluto is the prototype Plutoid. So a Plutoid is a round object in primary orbit around the star that has not cleared its orbit, that is orbiting beyond Neptune and made of a lot of ice. So if you're a big, round, icy object beyond Pluto, beyond Neptune, then you're a Plutoid.
Then you're a Plutoid.
A Plutoid. This is what was voted on, 90% approved, 10% dissented, and that is currently the official definition of it. But let me make it clear. I actually don't care how you define planet, because I got phone calls after 2006. That's when the letters dropped off, because now the entire community of astrophysicists were to blame, not just me. So the letter writing tailed off, and so what happened then is I got phone calls from the press saying, so you're going to change the exhibit now? You're going to change the number? We never counted planets to begin with, ever. So the exhibit was just fine.
In fact, that was the point. You made the exhibit so you wouldn't have to change it.
Thank you!
Yes.
Yes, that was the entire principle of the exhibit. And, may I say, that no matter how you define planet, I submit to you that that's not the most useful way to think about what orbits the solar system or orbits the sun. If one word, even if Pluto were a planet, you'd have Pluto described by the same word that describes Jupiter. And I'm thinking, of what value is that to the listener? If I say, I just discovered a planet around another star, you're going to ask me, is it big? Is it small? Is it rocky? Is it gaseous? Does it have rings? Is it in the habitable zone? Does it have moons? Does it have magnetic field? You're going to ask me 20 questions. And why? Because the word planet did not provide enough information to satisfy your curiosity. And any good lexicon ought to have the precision of description so that it shouldn't take 20 questions after that. If I come to a library and I say, I pulled a book off the shelf, I pulled a pamphlet off the shelf, I pulled an encyclopedia off the shelf, we have words where you kind of understand what I'm talking about without multiple questions that follow. So I claim that the vocabulary that has been voted on in Prague, that's where the vote was taken, first of all, is narrow-minded, because it really only applies to our own solar system. And if you're going to be classifying objects in orbit around a star, why not start taking cues from the 300-plus exoplanets that are now in the catalogs that we know orbit other stars? Why not allow that to inform the thinking? But it did not.
I was going to ask you about the exoplanets because they come in all kinds of shapes and sizes and things we've not seen in our own solar system, so it's likely to change again.
I think it should not have to have changed again. It should have thought about that from the beginning. Uh-huh. Wouldn't it be nice? The way I think of this, not that you ask, but I'm going to tell you. planet was okay as a word when all you knew was that there were dots of light on the sky. Even with primitive telescopic observations, we didn't really know that much about them physically. So planet was a nice kind of word because there was not much else to talk about. But we've had probes go by, orbit them, hang out there, plunge into the atmosphere, rovers roll on the surface. We've got close-up photos. Well, I got a lot more to talk about these objects. And I want the vocabulary of communication to reflect this fact. So I imagine a day when we have, and this is a little inelegant at the moment, but it'll convey my sentiment. You have a grid of data. One could be, is a planet orbiting? So you have all the objects orbiting the sun, including moons and comets. Here they are. And then you have criteria. Is it in the habitable zone? For example, that zone where you're not too close to the sun, where your water, if you have it, would evaporate. Not too far away, your water would freeze. So it'd be like Goldilocks. It'd be just right. And life as we know it requires liquid water. So if you want to look for life first, you know, out of the gates, you might start there. So isn't it habitable zone? Does its orbit cross the orbit of another object? Is it rocky? Does it have rings? So you have all of these, are there storms? And then you say to yourself, I want to study rings today. So you take a cut through the data and find all the objects that have rings, and that becomes your organizing principle. I want objects that have really well-preserved craters. Take another cut through the data. The moon will be in that list. And you have the moon and Mercury. I don't have a problem with that because the craters are your subject at that time. How about storms? Storms, Venus, Mars, Earth, the Jovians, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and I think, what's the one with the atmosphere? A Titan. I bet Titan has some storms. It's the only moon that has an atmosphere.
That was actually this week, rain on Titan.
Rain on Titan. You got weather there. So that's another cut through the data.
Yeah.
And so that's how I like cutting. And by the way, one of those cuts will be, are you round? Okay. But don't lead with that. Don't let that be your organizing principle. Don't let that define. And the elementary school exercise of counting planets and memorizing their sequence from the sun, that's a perversion of the science that's actually available to be learned at that age in school.
Now, one of my favorite quotations in here from the scientists were accusing you of revisionist science, which I thought was a wonderful oxymoron. Because isn't science actually supposed to be revisionist? Isn't that?
Yeah, that's kind
of
the whole
of
point. We're making discoveries, right? Yeah. That's what kind of that's. Yeah. But some people, you know what I think it was? Because I put a fair amount of thought into this.
Yeah.
When you learn something early in elementary school, And you didn't learn what things were. You just memorized something. That's really what happened there. And if you memorize something and then later on that breaks, you feel like something attacked you. You feel the memorization of the planets was kind of like an intellectual version of comfort food, right? It was just all was well in the world because there were nine planets and the ninth planet was Pluto. And you memorize it. Had you learned that these are dynamic bodies that have these properties, and then you learn that there are new objects that have new properties, I don't think people would have gotten upset. So I think we are participants in this blame because it's we or our professional brethren who wrote the textbooks that presented the information this way. So I don't want to implicate elementary schoolers uniquely in this. We all share this blame. But my hope is that in the textbooks to come, there will not be an exercise in memorizing planets, that you'll group them by like properties and teach them as any normal scientific subject would be addressed.
Well, I do want to remind you, pardon me, that you are in Los Angeles and just a few blocks from Disney Hall, so this is a kind of sacred territory.
Ooh, Disney.
Discussing that.
Disney comes into the picture for two reasons. First, I don't know if you know, 1930 was when Pluto, the cosmic object, was discovered. Same year, Walt Disney first sketched the dog that would bear that name. And so the dog and the cosmic object have the same tenure in the hearts and minds of Americans. Not only that, the age where you first learn the planets, you are a fan of cartoons at that age. Unless you're in a household of academics where there is no television, okay, then you're deprived of that background. But for most kids, and you learn the planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Pluto. Oh my gosh, that's the same as the dog. And then there's a link. There's like this.
Oh yeah, it's the cutest one too. It's the cutest planet.
Totally.
Yeah, there's a complete emotional link.
So the emotions are in place, and it's a recipe for clutching tightly to this ossified information.
So broadening just a bit, what do you think is next on the horizon for revisionist science? What are the new discoveries that are going to change how we see
okay,
our place?
I'll tell you about that. But before I answer that, can I just one little tidbit about Pluto? Because I worked hard to get this information. I can't keep it contained. I have to share it. The Pluto, again, you all are learned folk. So this is very low-level information for you. But you still might not have known it, and you still might think it's interesting. So grant me a moment to share it with you. I work now in the Department of Astrophysics at the American Museum of Natural History, which has multiple departments, mostly zoological departments. There's a Department of Entomology, which were an astronomer to have named it, it would just be called Bugology, right? there are the birdologists, the bugologists, The dinologists. The dinologists. I'd rather dino. So that's what we would have called them.
Yep.
But no, you got to find some obscure Latin root and name it that. So people then have to ask you what the frickin' word means. So anyhow, I'm closer to people who think about the order of animals in the world. And so it got me thinking. Here's Pluto the dog, owned by a mouse. So how is it that Mickey owns Pluto, but Pluto does not own Mickey? That disturbed me. That's a disruption in the mammalian order of things. And so I found out. In the Disney pantheon of characters that they created, not the ones they later bought that were preformed, like Winnie the Pooh, that's different. Ooh, I'm sorry, I meant to turn off my cell phone. Excuse me. Let me turn this off. Okay.
It's Pluto calling.
It's Pluto calling. I heard you.
Right. Down the street.
That's Pluto. Pluto just came out of his
came out of his dog house.
He's in a taxi right out front.
He's after you. Yes.
So it turns out in the Disney pantheon, if you are an animal that wears clothes, then you can be in possession, own any other animal that does not. And Mickey wears that with shorts and gloves, and I think sometimes he has a bow tie on, I seem to remember.
Yeah, he does.
And he can own Pluto, who's butt naked. That's what it is. And the other famous dog, Goofy, wears clothes and speaks and walks bipedally. Pluto does not speak. He only barks and walks on all fours. I know you were burning to know this, so I had to share this to you. So other things on the frontier. One of my favorite... one last thing. I got to tell you. Okay, do you have the book? You got this is like the reader's preview copy.
It is, yes.
Okay. I don't know if you guys knew this, but California passed proposed legislation regarding the demotion of Pluto. Did you know this? Your tax money at work. Yes. Okay. I have that entire legislation reproduced here. Okay. Oh, that's the resolution. Here we go. California's legislation relative to Pluto's planetary status. A California Assembly Bill H.R. 36, introduced by Assembly members Keith Richmond, M.D., Republican District 38, Northwest Los Angeles County, and Joseph Canciomila, a Democrat. So it's bipartisan legislation. Whereas recent astronaut, this was, by the way, this is passed like minutes after the vote was taken in Prague to demote Pluto. It's like 2 days later. So this must have been in the making for a while. And it's got all the whereas speak that resolutions typically have. Whereas recent astronomical discoveries, including Pluto's oblong orbit and the sighting of slightly larger Kuiper Belt objects, have led astronomers to question the planetary status of Pluto. And whereas the mean-spirited International Astronomical Union decided on August 24th to disrespect Pluto by stripping Pluto of its planetary status and reclassifying it as a lowly dwarf planet. And Pluto was Pluto was discovered in 1930 by an American, Clyde Tombaugh, in Arizona, and the discovery resulted in millions of Californians being taught that Pluto was the ninth planet in the solar system. And whereas Pluto, named after the Roman god of the underworld, and affectionately sharing the name of California's most famous animated dog, has a special connection with California history and culture. Whereas downgrading Pluto's status will cause psychological harm to Californians who question their place in the universe and worry about the instability of universal constants. This goes on. Your tax money at work. I'm skipping some. Resolved. There's more whereases. I'm skipping them. Resolved by the... I'm skipping. I got to skip that. I can't read that out loud. I won't read that out loud because you'll just move out of the state if you heard what this thing says.
Oh, Neil, I think you have to now.
I have to?
No, you've said that.
The second to last whereas. Whereas the downgrading of Pluto... I got to read, okay, here, before the one where you might think of moving out of the state, I got to read this one because it's so out there. Whereas the deletion of Pluto as a planet is a hasty, ill-considered scientific heresy similar to the Copernican theory, similar to questioning the Copernican theory, drawing maps of a round world and proving the existence of the time and space continuum. And here you go. The downgrading of Pluto reduces the number of planets available for legislative leaders to hide redistricting legislation and other inconvenient political reform measures. Be it resolved. This goes on. This is... I flew here. You guys live here. I'm just telling
right.
you. Anyhow, back to your question. I had to get that one off my chest here. The cartoons in it. Because once that happened, it wasn't just the school kids and the legislation. There was like cartoons and op-eds and The Onion. We all know The Onion, the newspaper. My favorite article in The Onion was, they're all fake articles, right? But they're brilliantly written. What NASA decides to send a consolar probe to Pluto. And it's filled with this sort of office protocol speak. It's like, the consolar probe will only approach Pluto on a Friday. to alert him of the downgrade so that he has the weekend to recover, okay? Because you don't fire people on a Monday. You fire them on a Friday. It's all this psycho speak to how the Consolar Probe will address Pluto. And another one, my favorite comic of them all, it's in here. Yes, it cost a small fortune, but I got the rights to put in all these really cool comics that that Pluto inspired. One of them is Pluto's this orb, this personified orb, you know, with eyes, nose, and mouth on a street corner, holding a beggar's cup, right? And there's and it's a sad Pluto holding up a sign that says, victim of downsizing. It's the cutest.
Well, it certainly struck a nerve.
Apparently.
You have to say that. Yes.
So other things I think interesting about changing paradigms or changing, how did you phrase it?
Well, I stole from Don Brownlee of the science, revisionist science.
Revisionist science, yeah. So a couple of interesting things. For the longest while, we identified what I earlier mentioned to you as the habitable zone around stars. It's really the Goldilocks zone. We're a little biased, but knowingly biased, that if we want to look for life, you want to start with life as we know it. And life as we know it includes dependence on liquid water. You start with life as we know it because who knows how many lives as we don't know it are possible. Yet there's no evidence of any one of them existing, so why don't we start with one for which we have an example, and that's ourselves. So you just start there. If that fails badly, then we sort of broaden the catcher's mitt. So we would look in the habitable zones around stars. We are most likely to find liquid water. But recently, last decade or so, we discovered that one of Jupiter's moons, Europa, one of the big four that Galileo first saw 400 years ago, almost to the week. I mean, it was these weeks, Galileo is observing the night sky, taking notes, the first to see what today we call the Galilean moons of Jupiter. So there's Europa. It is an icy body. That would be, if it was icy, we'd put a cut through the data, and Europa would be included among icy bodies. An icy body, yet close-up photos of its surface show cracks in the ice where it looks like liquid seeped up between the cracks and then refroze. If I held up a picture of the Arctic Sea and the ice sheets and the patterns of the broken and frozen ice, and I hold that next to the shots of Europa, you'd barely be able to tell the difference. So we conclude that beneath this frozen upper surface is an ocean of liquid water that has perhaps been liquid for billions of years. I got to say that the way Carl would have. For billions of years. Let's all say that together, just as an homage to Carl. Put your chin out. Together on three, you say with me. Ready? One, two, three.
Billions.
So, for Carl Sagan, that is, if you just moved out from under a rock, Carl Sagan. Yeah. Europa. Now Jupiter's well outside of the habitable zone, the green zone. Well, how does this happen? Because Jupiter's gravity in symphony with the gravity of the other Jupiter moons are tugging on Europa in such a way that it actually distorts the physical sphere that Europa is. It physically distorts it and reshapes it. And if you've ever played racket sports, they always say, let's warm up the ball for a few minutes before we start the game. That's literally true. You're smashing the ball squeezes, and then pops back into shape. So you're pumping energy into the ball, and the temperature of the ball actually goes up. On Europa, the physical stressing, the stressing of the physical body pumps heat into the object, into the moon. And it has melted that ice beneath the surface. And so I want to go ice fishing on Europa. Cut a hole in there, look down and see if anything swims up and licks the camera lens. That's what I want to do. And on top of that, the point here is, if you want to look for water, liquid water, you are no longer restricted. You no longer need to be restricted to the habitable zone because there are other mechanisms that can liquefy water that do not depend on the sun. And that's a broadening of the net that we will cast in search for life. But what adds to that is, in recent past, we've discovered life forms on Earth that thrive under conditions that would kill us post-haste. For so long, we said, well, what life needs is like a room temperature pond. No, we like room temperature, all right? If you put a polar bear in room temperature, it'd be dead. You know, not all life in the world likes room temperature. So bacteria comes in all shapes and sizes and varieties. Not all sizes, but definitely all varieties. And there are bacteria that thrive in acid mixtures, in basic mixtures, in high temperature, low temperature. You can freeze dry some bacteria and reconstitute it later. You can some bacteria thrives under conditions that we are finding on other cosmic objects. And so what that means is you no longer have to restrict yourself to room temperature. If life on Earth thrives under those conditions, bacterial life though it is, I don't care what kind of life you find. If it's life at all, that's a magical day in the history of science, even if it's just microbial life. So now when astronomers say we're looking for life in the universe, typically the astrobiologist, when they say that, they're not saying, you know, take me to your leader kind of life. Just any kind of microbial life will do.
Now, given your recent foray with the sociology between the public and science, if that fish came up and licked your lens, would you think there'd be a positive response or a negative response? Would people be elated and feel somehow part of something greater, or fearful and now just one of many? What would be the psychological?
That's an excellent question. Those who, in my judgment, and I didn't do formal research on this reply, but I've had enough encounters with enough people that I think I can have some insight. I declare that those who say or who feel threatened by this fact rather than enlightened by this fact that they are now part of an even greater biological system in the universe, if you feel threatened by that, it meant you were not properly educated to begin with. It meant somewhere in your educational path, your ego was boosted based on the assumption that you are separate and distinct from the physical world around you. And only under that construct could you possibly take that information as a threat or as something that undermines your place in the universe. And my sense of this is that the cosmic perspective, which the entire sort of astrophysics community has, because we live it. So I share with you not something that is unique to me. It's something that's common among those who think about the universe daily, is that when we look out into the universe, we know we are connected to it because the very elements in our body are traceable to these stars that manufactured them, exploded, scattered them into the galaxy, out of which we form the stars and planets, even dwarf planets, on which you then find the ingredients for life. So we look up, we don't feel small, we actually feel quite large because we are a participant in a much larger story than ourselves. And so, yes, there'll be issues. There's talk about whether sort of religions would object. There's a whole theology, scholarship, theologians, so theology scholars, theologians, who are thinking about what to do if they find sort of intelligent life on another planet, particularly Christian theology. They worry, is that life saved? Are they subject to original sin? These are theological questions being tackled right now, now that they see sort of the astrophysical frontier coming, you know, on those shorelines, ready to sort of snap into, reach out into those domains. So I've had some people say, well, will religion go away? Well, religion didn't go away when Galileo showed that Earth is not the center of all motion, and that there are huge institutions with a lot of money invested in it, and a lot of sort of... So what I have seen happen in the past is that there's rethinking of this the religious text, and they sort of adapt to the new information and push on. So there will be change in society, but it's not going to, I don't think it's going to uproot society any worse than the Copernican Revolution did in terms of the institutions that thrive within it.
I do recall that when NASA announced life in the meteorite that fell in Antarctica, ALH 84 with lots of zeros and a one, that it was the second news story on the news that day. And Robert Dole was running for president, and the first story was his plank on abortion, which he announced that day. So the announcement of life on Mars didn't actually make the number one story on the news that night, which is kind of an interesting
although,
perspective. We tend to think it'll change everything, but
right, yeah, but yeah,
not.
I don't think it'll change everything. It'll be important. And by the way, I think what matters there, though,
yeah,
if I may say, I've been on TV a lot lately, but you guys are readers, so you wouldn't know this. Okay. let me just tell. Let's test this. How many here in this room watch any weekday night sitcom? Raise your hand. Oh, okay. We got some TV readers here. Okay. I mean, TV readers, TV watchers. Oh, yeah, and PBS. Yes, some people, the TV station never goes off of PBS. That's the rest of you, perhaps. Those of you. Oh, we have a Daily Show person there. Yes, good. The Daily Show. I'm a little worried because I had a Rubik's Cube moment on the Daily Show, and there's someone in the front row who brought a Rubik's Cube right here. Test me on that later. I solved the Rubik's Cube in the green room of the Daily Show, and that I was alone when I did it, but they came by and saw it, and then it became a subject the next show, and they talked about it. And so now that's all I get in my emails. Is what. But so what I want to say is I've been on TV a lot lately, but I keep data on this. Of all the times I'm on television, because I'm being interviewed, right, because I have this expertise, and I'm 10 blocks away from all the major news gathering headquarters. So I'm an easy date for them. They don't have to fly anybody in for half of what they do. 85% of them, of these encounters with the media, are not initiated by some marketing group or because there's some product that comes out. 85% of them are unsolicited by me or any other part of me inquiries because the universe flinched and they want a soundbite. And only 15% is because of some product. What that tells me is that whatever makes the top story, I'm happy to report that the universe consistently does make some kind of headlines. And that life on the Mars meteorite story, while it was not the top story, it did get an announcement from the White House, from the White House lawn. President Clinton announced that story from the White House lawn. He did not announce Bob Dole's position on abortion from the White House lawn. And that story stayed in the news for much longer than others of these. So all told, I'm actually quite happy with the trends that I've seen. The public appetite for the universe is large, and many of us, and Laura included, who works at the Griffith Observatory and Planetarium, are servants of that public interest. And so we're happy to play that role at all times.
Well, that is a wonderful segue to the fact that I know there are many questions in the audience, and I've barely even asked any of mine, but I can't hog all the time. So I think we have a few people with microphones, and if you have a question for Dr. Tyson, please raise your hand. Oh, sure. There's a fellow right in back with his hand up. He's the first one I saw right there.
Thank you, Dr. Tyson. I find you to be very engaging and entertaining, and you make science accessible. But when you pulled up the headline from the New York Times, it reminded me of the beginning of the Dark Ages, as I call them. And I was wondering if you'd reflect on the damage, if any, done to scientific research and education, and the fact that we had to have a president actually say he's restoring science to its proper place in our society.
Okay. That's not a quick answer. Right. I started life. I grew up in New York City. My parents were active in the civil rights movement. New York is basically a liberal town, liberal, Democrat, anti-war town, statistically, in New York City, that is, not the state. And so these are my political leanings. If you ask me, I'd say I'm left of liberal. Okay. Meanwhile, over the past 8 years, during what you just referred to as the Dark Ages, I was 3 times appointed by President Bush to serve on 2 commissions. These are high-level studies that are conducted, requested by the White House. Congress can also call for a commission. I was on a White House commission appointed by Bush twice. A third appointment was on the committee. I served on the committee to select who would be the winners of the Presidential Medal of Science, the highest award our government gives a scientist. That's an award that's then bestowed around the neck by the president himself. So this was kind of a baptism into the world of Republicans, because I barely knew any Republicans, right? If you're in New York, do you say, oh, yeah, that's a Republican back there in the last row. Everyone look. Can you see the Republican? That's how often you run into a Republican in New York. And so, well, one of the commissions was on the future of the aerospace industry, which was on hard times. They had lost 500,000 jobs in the previous 10 years, and no one really understood why. And we knew that if we lost our aerospace industry, it could affect commerce, it could affect transportation, it could affect security, that sort of thing. The next commission I was appointed to was on the future of NASA. After we lost the Columbia space shuttle coming in, everyone has paused and rethought what is our mission. Bush called for a commission to study the future of NASA. While there, I'm meeting Republicans. I'm meeting educated Republicans, intelligent Republicans, Republicans who have thought through issues and problems. I also found that coming to meet them, the only way I can have a conversation is if I sort of walk my way into the middle, okay? And they too. So we're all in the middle, just having a, when I say middle, I don't mean compromise in that sense. When I say middle, I mean there are issues that affect all Americans, and we all want the best solution for as many Americans as possible. So there is a huge middle that goes, so I come to learn, there's a huge middle that goes on daily in Congress that you never hear about, because it doesn't make interesting news stories. Because it's not, it doesn't issue forth from conflict. It issues forth because it's just the right thing to do that any sentient American would choose to do. Among them is, let's fix the aerospace industry. These commissions turn out to be basically nonpartisan, not even bipartisan, but nonpartisan. It turns out support for NASA is not predictable based on your political affiliation. So NASA is not even bipartisan, it is nonpartisan. And I'll give you an example. Right when Bush says, I want to rejuvenate NASA, send people to the moon and onto Mars and beyond, immediately the Democratic left said, let's send Bush to Mars. We got enough problems here on Earth. So that's the posturing that you can only make if you're standing out here. But after a few months, people just thought about it. It's actually a quite sensible program. It was completely sensible. Any person thinking about what was written there, and divorce yourself from how much you might have disliked the Bush administration, just read the thing. You realize this is kind of makes a lot of sense. So a few months later, Congress voted 340 to 25 in favor of the resolution that supported that document. That's again a nonpartisan vote, basically, when you have those kinds of numbers. So that's my preamble to something simple. I want to get to as many questions as we can, but this is important. In Washington, what is your measure of support for science? Is it what anybody says, or is it where money gets spent? Basically, in Washington, it's where money gets spent, sensibly, because that's kind of the only point of Congress, to spend the $3 trillion that of the budget each year. And that how you spend it is the portfolio of what defines this nation, period. If you ask people, someone from the far left, tell me about Bush and science. Oh, he hates science. The Republicans hate science. And it go on, and it was like, and so, well, all right. Well, what about it? So give me examples. And you get basically only three examples. You get his record on the environment, stem cells. That's pretty much kind of it. And that's given as the example of the Republicans having a war on science. Meanwhile, over that time, the budget for the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, tripled. Over that time, the budget for the National Science Foundation went up by like 40%. Over that time, the budget for NASA went up by about 20%. Not as much as we all wanted, but it went up. During the Clinton administration, the budget for NASA dropped by 25% over those 8 years. So Then you look at the issues that Bush was resistant to scientifically, and they were all traceable to the fundamentalist Christian electorate that helped to get him into office in the first place. So it makes complete sense that that's what his posturing would be. I wasn't even surprised by that. Remember, I'm standing in the middle now just watching politics unfold. That's the politics of it. You can't go to Washington and say, oh, that's politics. Of course it's politics. It's Washington, D.C. As an academic, I came to it first as an academic, and I said, there's a problem here because it gets so political. You know, to an academic, politics is a boundary, is a barrier between where you are and where you want to land. In Washington, it is the currency. So once you understand that, then navigate that. Okay? The Dover, Pennsylvania trial on intelligent design. Everyone on the left was worried because the judge presiding over it was Bush appointed. I'd spent enough time with Republicans by then and understood the system so that I was not worried at all. If to remind you, there was a court case where the school board wanted to introduce what's called intelligent design into the science classroom. And intelligent design is the premise that there are some things in nature that are not accountable by scientific means, and they must have a divine, or they would say, a source of intelligence greater than humans that made it happen. Which is not science, it's religion, basically. Okay, so therefore it doesn't belong in the science. Put it wherever else, it doesn't go in the science classroom. So, and that's a whole other conversation if you'd like to have it, but we start here with Pluto, so I just wanted to, and I'm almost done, believe it or not, with your answer. So, I wasn't worried at all, I just sat back. I just chilled out, okay? Why? Because one of the reasons why funding for science under Republican administrations has historically been higher than that under Democrats post-Second World War is because Republicans, more than Democrats, recognize the value of R&D on a later return on that investment in discoveries that could come out of a company, for example. So the Democrats are busy creating a social program to help the needy and the poor. The Republicans are investing in a corporation that, at least in the model that they expect to happen, would then make jobs later on because of new industries. Okay? One is socially driven, the other one is economically driven, in a gross stereotype of the behavior. Okay? So, but the fact is, funding for science under Republican administrations has been historically higher than under Democrats. Knowing this, and knowing that innovations in science and technology are the engines of economic growth, as they have been since the Industrial Revolution, I knew, above all else, there is a truth that no Republican wants to die poor. Therefore, if you start bringing things that are not science into a science classroom, you undermine the science curriculum, preventing America from being leaders in science evermore. And then you end up dying poor. And if you read the court case as written by the judge, it is an example in scientific pedagogy. I recommend you dig it up online. It's brilliantly written. It says what science is and what isn't and why ID is not science. So I don't think it was the black hole of science that everyone says. What one should argue is one should not politicize science. And that's a different argument from saying that science was not treated with higher budgets, because in fact it was. So that's a long answer, but I had to. I stood in the middle. I didn't know I could stand in the middle. I stood in the middle and saw what I didn't see before. Okay. By the way, there's hot air on both ends of the spectrum. So you want to get rid of the hot air, and then we can actually have a real conversation and do what's in the interest of the nation rather than in the interest of the fight that you'd rather have because it sells papers.
Hi, good evening. Hi. Do you know anything about the planet X?
Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah. Well, do you want the planet X of yesteryear or the planet X that people are talking about today?
Today.
Oh.
I know a little bit about yesteryear.
Okay. The planet X today is a marvelous work of fiction. Oh, yes. Yes, there is no such thing as planet Nimburu or whatever they say. It's just fiction. And they cite sources that cite NASA sources. They don't cite NASA. Check the websites, you'll see. And it's all related to the doomsday predictions of the year 2012. Yes, that's what you're getting at. That's behind your question, isn't it? Yes. 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 You want to know if the world is going to end on December 21st, 2012. Because the same website that tells you about Planet X, this secret planet that will has a strongly elliptical orbit that will come into our zone in 2012 and knock Earth off its axis, combined with, on December 21st, 2012, that the center of the galaxy, the Sun and the Earth, will come into perfect alignment, and the excess gravity will then also tip Earth off its axis, and it'll be end of the world as we know it. This is what these web pages will tell you. Turns out, if you go to December 21st and look at the star charts, it's true. The center of the galaxy, the Sun and the Earth, will come into perfect alignment. It will. It's true. It's true. What the site does not tell you is that that happens every year on December 21st. They left that out of the account. So it's a fun work of fiction. Earth will be here before, during, and after 2012. I will add that the movie 2012 that's being marketed right now, that's going to come out in 2012, and they want you to do all the homework for the movie. So they say, just Google it. And if you Google 2012, it's filled with thousands of web pages on doomsday written by people who didn't take enough science in school. So you Google it. I saw some of the previews for it, and I was worried that all of us in this business would just be inundated with having to sort of correct misconceptions. And then I saw what they actually show in the movie. And the movie's like, aliens come, and they take over the Capitol. And I said, oh, that's just another sort of, like the movie Independence Day. And that's fine. It's just Hollywood.
There's a question in the front here.
Thanks for coming, Doc. Appreciate you. Wanted to know, are there any theories circulating about the planets accelerating in their orbits and thus accelerating time, or is that just fiction as well?
Well, any object that does not move in a straight line is actually accelerating. It's not a familiar usage of the word accelerate, but in fact, you're accelerating. Anytime you accelerate, you will feel some kind of like in a car, if you floor the accelerator pedal, your head jerks back. If you make a quick left turn, your body tips to the right. So your body's going to react anytime a system accelerates, abruptly, if it accelerates. So we accelerate all the time. And Earth, by its motion and by the acceleration, there is a slight, what we call time dilation, as predicted by Einstein's theories of relativity. But it's small, and it's not even interesting to measure. You got to be appreciably, you need speeds that rival the speed of light for this effect to be interesting. So, yeah, you can measure this with very precise tools. In fact, the GPS satellite system factors in relativity to get the time correct because it has very high precision, precision on the level that none of us would really know about or care about. So it's there, but no, there's nothing to worry about. You're not going to wake up into next week, tomorrow. Just, you're fine. Okay. We'll wake up one morning with a beard, It's like...
This young woman from MIT.
I'm 10 years old, and I want to be an astronomer when I grow up. Do you have any advice for me?
Laura, you could take that one, too. Go for it.
Oh, my. Certainly, if you already know that that's your passion.
Laura, what college did you go to?
I went to Yale.
To Yale, okay. Yeah. She went to the fancy colleges, too. Yeah. So, and you have it wearing an MIT sweater? Like, show everyone your MIT sweater. It might be less familiar in these parts because you have the California Institute of Technology here. In that shirt, the M stands for Massachusetts. Yes, okay. Yeah, cool.
Then I think you have all the ingredients. Because passion is the first and foremost important part. And if you're lacking that, then, you need to find what your passion is and go for that. But if the passion is there, it will drive you to study. I don't need to tell you to study because you'll study. And I don't need to tell you to learn to write because you'll learn to write because you need to write proposals to get funds to do research. And, all those things will fall in line. So, you know, the one thing I do, your 10's a little on the young side, but to high school students, I do advise that they select a college where they will be feel comfortable and happy and want to learn. You know, so it may be that MIT is the right school for you, but an undergraduate education is essential for really learning your physics. So you need to be where there's a department that you feel comfortable with, professors that you like. If you're out there struggling on your own and kind of alienated in your college environment, that's not so great. Grad school is when you want to go for the big name places. But if you do well as an undergraduate in a college that suits you and where you're happy, and of course you do the work, then that's the one piece of advice I do give to young folks is really focus on that college selection for you, to nurture you. Grad school will launch you on your career.
And I was 9 years old when I had my first sense that I wanted to do astrophysics. And beginning at age 11 is when it was cemented. And I got my first telescope on my 12th birthday. But you already have a telescope, so you're like already there. And if you have, if you're as passionate as you are, you will not be among those who will one day not be an astrophysicist.
Yeah. It will naturally come. And let me just unabashedly say, and come to Griffith Observatory. There are many programs and further ways to further your interest there. So, way in the back in the corner.
Thank you for thank you both for being here today. I was just going to ask because you recommended that we expand the vocabulary of astronomy to include planetoids and all that stuff. And if you do that, won't you get away from the whole idea that you know astronomy is full of these simple words? And wouldn't it make it harder for third graders to understand it and really appreciate it and write you letters?
That's an excellent question. It goes two ways. If there aren't many objects, then you can just make up fun words for them that are sensible and you just stick with that. The moment you have objects beyond what can be sensibly named, then you have to go into a more formal classification scheme. Our stars, for example, are classified in a slightly arcane way, but precisely, with high precision. And so the sun, for example, whether or not you knew this, is a capital letter G, Arabic numeral 2, Roman numeral 5. Okay? G25, that's what it's called. And so it's a G star. So each of those things means something, okay, for its class. And we needed that because the stars were coming in at us from every direction. And so the stars are lettered. There's any one of 8 letters that they can have, and their numbers, subcategories of those letters, and then the Roman numerals can go 1 through 7. And so it gets arcane, and that removes some of the romance. But I can tell you that some of the brighter stars in the night sky still have regular names. If you look in a journal, we're not going to call the brightest star in the night sky Sirius. We're not going to use that designation for it. We'll stick to the romantic labels that they've had from antiquity. So it may be the day will come that solar systems and their contents have enough diversity that we'll need a more formal, less romantic scheme. And you're right, it'll become less accessible in that way to elementary schoolers. So you pick some of those things that are just fun, like what's dense like a rock or big and bulbous like beach balls, and you bring in a beach ball and a rock. You know, you pick and choose, and that's still, you can still do that. I'm not going to require they learn everything in third grade, but let them learn some actual science and not think that memorizing planets in order from the sun with a mnemonic is science.
Well, we have time for just 2 more questions, and I see this gentleman in the front has had his hand up for a while.
Thank you for coming. I like the characters that you play on Nova Science Now. can you tell us if you have an opinion or any thoughts on CERN and the LHC and what it's going to be bringing to us?
Indeed, the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, is currently the most powerful particle accelerator in the world. That might have been in Texas, but Congress voted to cancel the superconducting supercollider that the physicist had proposed. By the way, had astronomers proposed that, we would call it the super-duper collider. See, that's what we would have done. Another one is the physicists are in Congress, you know, defending the budget that this would require, because Congress initially agreed earlier in the 80s, and they got cut as we sort of exited the 80s when the budget flinched. What else happened at the end of the 80s? Oh, I know. The Cold War ended. Oh. Physicists had, you know, wore shiny badges during the Cold War because physicists won the Second World War with their weapons. And so the value of physics as a defense investment was manifest. Without defense, voting $30 billion just to discover a new particle wasn't going to fly, it turns out. And so there's the physicist in the room, and I forgot whether it was in the Senate or the House, but they're getting questioned on what this would discover. This is the accelerator in America, and I'll get to that IC in a minute, but this is an important story. And so they're asked, so doctor, what, you know, will this accelerator, will it see the face of God? And the physicist said, Senator, it will see the Higgs boson. That's the particle they're looking for. Now, I think astronomer would have had a better answer for that, I think. There are ways to get that one out without sort of compromising your principles. So we could recommend, for example, I heard Michio Kaku mention this, a friend of mine back in New York, a physicist. What you could have said then is, Senator, whatever is your concept of God, this particle accelerator will bring you closer to it. They might have still gotten funding, okay? They might have. So, we don't have it. The center of mass of particle physics is no longer in America. It's in Europe. That's the thing about science. Anybody can do it if you have the vision and the resources. The Large Hadron Collider is going to sample the states of matter that have never been sampled at the higher energies than have ever been sampled before. And the higher the energies you go, the closer back in time your cavity will look like the Big Bang, okay? Because the Big Bang was a time when the whole universe was small under conditions of pressure and temperature that they're recreating inside this accelerator. Do you remember what the big fear was?
And still
the
is.
Black hole.
Oh,
apparently.
Yeah, it's still out there.
It's going to make a black hole, and it was going to eat the Earth. And it turns out we get bombarded by high-energy particles daily that dwarf the energies created in this. Nature is a much bigger particle accelerator than anything our hardware can produce. And these particles would have surely turned Earth into a black hole long ago. That's number one. Number two, I don't know if you check this, but the week the LHC was turned on, that was the same week of Wall Street collapse and the financial market collapsed. So I think the black hole went to Wall Street is what happened. Sucked all the money out of the economy. That's what happened there. So it's a tremendous international collaboration. And the black holes, people fear frontiers of physics. They've done it ever since the atom was first split. So people's concerns don't surprise me. It's our goal to make sure people are scientifically literate and so that they can make an informed decision about information that comes across your newspaper headlines.
Our last question in the back.
You're the last one, so it better be like the best question ever.
Yeah, but no pressure.
I'll try. I have a list given to me by my daughter.
Okay.
What's the most shocking thing you've ever discovered about space?
Most shocking thing. Space in general or the universe? When you say space, I'm thinking empty space. Oh, the universe. Oh, most shocking thing? I'd say the most shocking and most seductive thing about the universe is that 85% of all the gravity we measure in the universe is traceable to something about which we know nothing. And we call it dark matter. We don't know what it is. We don't know. We have never seen it except for its gravity. We are dumb stupid about what this stuff is, but we know it's there. And that's 85% of all the gravity we've ever measured in the universe is traceable to that. And okay, I was okay, I got used to that. And then who ordered up the following? That now you look at the expanding universe and you find out it's accelerating. There's some anti-gravity pressure that's making the universe expand faster than the natural other forces would have it behave. We don't know what's causing that either. That's called dark energy. And dark energy is 94% of all the matter energy in the universe. So all the science, all everything we ever talk about is contained within 4% of what the universe is. And so there's a lot to learn out there, and which brings to mind the famous comment about cosmic discovery, that the greater is your area of knowledge, as your area of knowledge grows, so too does your perimeter of ignorance.
Well, that's a beautiful thought to end on.
Okay.
I think we can't go further than that. Thank you very much, Neil.
Thank you. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.